Chapter 14. A Tale of Two Colonies. The colony at Lycos had been no more than a knot of hardy ecologists and xeno-agriculturalists before the waves of refugees arrived. Life on Lycos was hard, the struggle to tame enough land to support people constant, starvation an ever-present shadow. And then, in the year 48 after, the architect came. It had burst from unspace without warning. Back then, before the intermediary program, it was always without warning, and descended on the planet with unmistakable intent. Lycos had few ships. Those that had dropped off the refugees had already been deployed elsewhere. Evacuating the colony was simply impossible. The people planetside had plenty of time to understand what was about to happen to them. The architect turned from a point of light, to a dot, to a fist, to a second satellite whose thousand mountain-sized spines stabbed accusingly down at the planet. And hung there. And hung there. The science station at the heart of the colony had turned every appropriate instrument on the architect, determined to gather and transmit what data it could before the end. And then the architect departed, leaving Lycos somehow whole and unmolested. For the first time in humanity's experience, the great gods of change and destruction had stayed their hand. The scanner records showed a signal emanating from the architect, solitary and singular as whale song, directed at a very specific point on planet. A flyer expedition hastily mounted discovered something. Later researchers would characterize it as an outpost. There was little of it left, and what was there was buried 20 meters down in Lycos's acidic soil. The remains of three chambers, interconnected, spherical, partly flattened by long millennia of compression. Certain artifacts of uncertain purpose, rods, crooks, and key-like objects, all small enough to be held in a human hand. Analysis of both ruin and rods failed to reveal how they were made, which in itself taught more than anything else. The fine structure of the materials did not conform to the rules of atomic bonds and molecular chemistry that applied to all matter discovered so far. Its substance was written in a language unrelated to the periodic table. Exact dating was similarly frustrated, and the site interacted with the geology of Lycos in inexplicable ways. The unknown creators were dubbed the originators. Later research would link them to the creation of the unspaced throughways too. Right then, humanity seized onto one key idea. Whoever or whatever they had been, the architects feared them. Even their million-year-old relics were enough to send the gargantuan destroyers away. In the wake of the Lycos discovery, a survey team on Charm Prime reported finding similar relics on that barren, blasted world. Charm Prime had been named by a real joker. The world was arid, devoid of life. The same hadn't always been true. There were signs of a thriving biosphere and some kind of civilization dating from at least 100,000 years before, including roads and the ground-down traces of ruins. The fate of the world and its inhabitants was unclear, but lingering areas of radiation raised some grim possibilities. However, in the midst of the largest and most intact ruin was what hazmat-suited archaeologists had labelled a shrine. It didn't seem to be made by originators, but the contents were uncannily similar to the objects found at Lycos. They had already been old, perhaps venerated, when the Charm Prime civilization had been bombing itself and its world into oblivion. Nobody wanted to settle Charm Prime, bar one apocalyptic religious sect. However, a short throughway linked that world to Caris, where a commune government had been taking in large numbers of refugees. Caris was a good world, able to support many fleeing humans. And when its government took possession of the originator relics, there wasn't much the Charm Prime faithful or the archaeologists could do. Scientific research and faith both came second to saving lives. Not long after, an architect did come to the burgeoning world of Caris. There was little attempt at evacuation. They trusted the originators to save them. They were mistaken. Caris joined the ranks of reworked worlds, another planet-scale martyr to the architect's craft. That was how humanity learned the second lesson on originator regalia. You cannot move them. Oh, on planet, certainly. But the moment mankind took these objects into unspace, they became just things, useless sticks and stones, objects of ritual significance only. Just another inexplicable mystery attached to the originators, that hypothetical ancient civilization which raised only unanswerable questions. Except, the relics could be moved in a way that preserved their integrity. A few years after the loss of Caris, during the thick of the war, colonial diplomats finally disentangled the Essiel's most important message. It was what hegemonic representatives had been trying to communicate ever since humans first ran into them. The hegemony was asking humans to submit to their rule, not through threats, but via a particularly potent promise. The Essiel knew all about the architects, from before humans had even smelted bronze. They too had discovered the protection these long-gone originators could still provide. But they had discovered how to transport the regalia. Every single hegemony world was protected from architect attention. In return for the subservience and obeisance of their subjects, they offered life. When this became clear, human worlds began to open private channels to the Essiel. The hegemony began to acquire human subjects, one planet at a time. And what could the colonial governments do, precisely? It wasn't as though they had a better offer, right then? Chris. Chris had lived out of the Vulture God for 4 years. She knew it backwards. She knew its sounds too, but they had always been the sounds of other people. Barney cursing recalcitrant mechanisms, Ollie clattering about in one of her frames as she worked on the remotes, the tap-tap of Kittering's many feet, Rollo's rich voice. Alone in unspace, the ship was ghastly. Her every step, every shuffle echoed against the metal walls. Idris had said, "Be still, close your eyes," as they dropped into the void. But that wasn't an option. Without those little scuffs and rustles from her, there was only the silence. And the silence was terrible, because it wasn't quite complete. She was alone on the Vulture God. Or no, she wasn't alone. She'd read about this, watched mediotypes. Your mind populated the absence with a spurious presence. It was just sensory deprivation, operating on a hitherto unexamined sense. Pacing past the little cells of the crew cabins, Chris could sense there was something out there. When she moved, it moved. When she was still, it waited, a little closer every time, stalking her at its leisure. People went mad, tried to destroy themselves, tried to destroy their ships. The alternative would be coming face to face at last with it, and that was literally unbearable. You'd do anything to avoid looking into that mirror. And the fact that everyone who came out of Unspace sane and hale reported the same delusion was not a comfort. Because Chris couldn't stop thinking, surely there was only one logical explanation to everyone having the same experience. But despite everything, there really was something out there. Unspace had a single and inimitable denizen, and she was trapped in here with it. Now she felt it creep closer, silent, utterly undetectable, imaginary, except that she knew it was there. She was playing a game as she walked through the Vulture God, feeling that other take a step for every one of hers as it stalked her. She was in the God's command pod now, with its empty pilot's chair. It lurked, just on the other side of the door. She knew it, for certain. For God's sake, Chris, keep it together. Her hand had drifted up to the door panel of its own accord. She absolutely did not want to see what was there. Yet her hand wanted to remove the one thin barrier between her and it. And she wondered, what if this is what happens to those who end themselves? They look into its face. Or what if some who come out of Unspace aren't even the same people anymore, their minds twisted by this other? Her arm twitched convulsively, pushing towards the door control. I can't stop myself. She knew with utter horror that she was going to open the door. Then the world dropped out from underneath her. The Vulture God wrenched its way out of Unspace into the real, and she opened the door. Ollie was on the far side, in her Scorpion, one battered manipulator extended to do exactly the same. They shared a wide-eyed stare.
Check in, please, came Idris's voice over the comms.
Here, Chris confirmed, and saw Ollie's lips shape the same word. Kittering and Solace followed suit from wherever they had ended up in the ship. What if I'd been on the same side of the door as Ollie? She wondered, trembling slightly. It didn't happen somehow. As though people, no matter how alone, retained some knowledge of what space was already occupied.
Let's not do that again, she suggested, shipwide.
They'd wanted to get clear of Tarakuma as fast as possible, and bedding down would have taken precious time. Idris hadn't liked the idea, but they'd wanted him to just get them the hell out of there.
Idris doesn't ever go into suspension.
Chris felt sick at the thought, and simultaneously, wretchedly grateful that someone would do this dreadful thing for her, so she'd never have to do it again. Inside the wreck of the Amaru, they found a compartment set into the wall of what had once been the hold. It was just large enough to hold the box the hijackers had retrieved. Inside that box, held in some manner of suspension, was a handful of corroded, broken-ended rods and a spiked disc, all apparently made of some ancient greenish-black stone. To the untutored eye, all that was available, they looked disturbingly like originator regalia.
Fakes, Ollie said flatly into a silence. Must be fakes. You can't just lug them about. Everyone knows that.
Hegemonics can, Solace said softly. No one knows how, but we know they can. They stared at the box, now resting at a slant on one of the command consoles. It was still open,
displaying its impossible contents for all to see.
"This is..." Idris started, and then stopped.
Chris knew why. This was big. They had found something literally worth a world's ransom. What wouldn't a colonial government, a Hani trade consortium, or a Castigar World Council give for this? For protection against the architects, especially now? What wouldn't the hegemony give too, to get these relics back? Assuming they were genuine. No, even if they're not. After all, how would you go about testing them? Money back if the architects destroy your world.
"Inestimable value here," Kittering spoke up,
calculations scrolling down his arm screens too fast to follow.
"Literally inestimable. Priceless. Price less. Invaluable. Without value."
"What are you babbling about?" Molly snapped at him. "You could sell these."
She trailed off.
"If we were Broken Harvest, maybe we could sell them for some stupid amount that was still stupidly low for what they're worth," Chris said. "But we're just us. And the moment we tried to put these on the market, 1,000 different groups would work out we're far easier to just kill, even if we sold them for a song."
"Asses," Ollie breathed, staring at their newfound treasure.
"Anyway," Idris put in, "we have something else to do first."
Spacer funerals weren't elaborate. There was no grand ritual to it, no protected ceremony, fancy hangings or pretty caskets. Most of the human race simply hadn't been able to pack those old Earth traditions when the evacuation call went out. And so, the Spacer's Wake tradition came about.
"Captain Rollo Rostand," Ollie announced.
They were in the Vulture's drone bay, because there was more room there. It was a novelty for spacers to have a physical body present. Not knowing what else to do, Chris had printed out Rollo a fresh set of shipboard clothes and dressed him in his father's old jacket. He had newly printed sandals on his cold, dead feet, and they were slightly askew. Chris kept wanting to adjust them, as though Rollo might get blisters wherever he was going. Ollie took a deep breath.
"Born 73 after, on orbital Nexus 7 over Tourmaline," she said,
and looked around at the others.
"Terrible gambler,"
Chris put in dutifully, staring down at the man's body. He had been by far the best captain she and Idris had signed on with, despite his flaws, because of his flaws. No slave driver, no profit chaser, no margin cutter, and so never quite the successful man of business some of his peers were. But a far better captain to work under, for all that.
"Too quick with his fists by half," Idris said faintly.
He looked to Kittering, but the Hani was tilted forwards, screened dark and arms motionless. The silence stretched out, until Chris elbowed Solace. Ollie looked as though she would object to the Partheni getting a word in, but then scowled and subsided.
"No sense of delegation."
And to her credit, Solace looked as upset as any of them, despite only having known Rollo for a short time. Chris wondered what they'd taught her to expect of a colony man with a command position. Nothing good, probably. So maybe meeting Rollo had shaken her preconceptions. Ollie sighed.
"Our father he was. Our grandfather. Our uncle. A captain of his own ship. Loyal to his crew and safe hands. Died in space where we all die, where he belonged. One of ours he was."
Chris mumbled the last few words along with her, adding this grief to the others stored up inside her, the way spacers did,
And sometime in the future, there'd be somewhere to drink. Some place that didn't need clear minds and constant maintenance to keep it together. And then the grief would get a round bought for it, and more than one, and have its edges dulled.
"This is not correct,"
Kittering's translator piped up.
"Observation of set protocols is recognised and observed, but no, not for him. Grand tragedy of a lost nurse demands pledges of furtherance and dedication."
They stared at him. Chris glanced to Ollie, finding the same lack of understanding there.
"He produced zero offspring in continuation of his germline," Kittering's translator rattled, turning Hanny concepts into their nearest human equivalents. "He dedicated himself to the nurturing of others, of us, of we. He nursed us. He was our teacher. Our teacher!"
And there were nuances of meaning that just weren't coming through.
"I pledge to him that when I give up myself to continuation, he shall be added to the pool of names. I dedicate 19 eggs to Captain Rollo Rostand."
Later, Chris slept on this, and on what she knew of the Hanalambra, and thought she understood. Right then, none of it had made sense, save that the little alien was as upset as any of them, and needed to express this in his own way, beyond the stripped-down envelope of a spacer's funeral, before they sent Rollo off to roam the universe on his last eternal voyage. And after that, there was the box. It was still on the Vulture's command console, open and waiting for them, its contents shimmering within a field Ollie had not been able to analyse. "Some kind of gravitic interaction," was all she could say for certain. "No idea how there's any kind of generator in that little box. And you don't feel any push or pull, even when holding the case." "Open it up," Chris suggested. "See how it's done." When the drone specialist looked at her, she shrugged. "If we find out, the information alone would be worth every Tothiat assassin in the hegemony after us," Idris suggested wryly. "It's hegemony tech." Ollie squinted at the box, as though trying to see into its substance. "You ever hear of transient component engines? The high-level Essial stuff, not the toys they give to their underlings. They generate ghost fields in fluids, so that the substrate springs into the shapes they need. Infinitely reconfigurable tech. You need a toaster? It's a toaster. You need a cutting torch? It's a cutting torch." "They need a lot of toasters in the hegemony," Chris asked, intentionally trying to keep things light now the funeral was done.
"Means if you take it apart, the gubbins just splats out the bottom of the box and you got nothing. Even with top flight lab equipment, nobody's been able to learn much from hegemony tech. And you can bet they protect this particular golden nugget with a lot of fail-safes."
"Question," from Kit, and his screens flashed up. "Aklu's equivalence to hegemony?"
"I guess it's not officially hegemony," Idris shrugged. "But what do the Essial think about one of their own going renegade for a life of crime? Same as for anything. Nobody knows."
"We can't just sit on this," said Solace. It was her first contribution since the funeral.
"Sure you've got a load of suggestions," Ollie growled.
"If these are real, we have the tools to save a planet," Solace said.
Idris glanced at her warily, sensing a slight distance that hadn't been there before.
"Query as to which planet?" Kit chirped.
"You don't understand. We have the tools to save any planet. If we can ship it out in time, the next planet an architect shows up at can be saved, just by getting this box groundside."
Solace went on implacably. "Assuming these relics are genuine, which they may not be."
Assuming the field holding them lasts indefinitely, which it may not, Chris added. Aklu might have been desperate to get them back because it's about to run out of battery.
Even so, Solace said, we have a duty.
Let me guess, Ollie broke in loudly. This comes down to giving it over to the Parthenon. Slice it thin as you want. That's what this is about, no?
You want to give it to Hugh?
Solace wasn't backing down this time, meeting Ollie's angry stare.
Or maybe the hegemony? Some Magdan boyer with deep pockets. Kittering, you've a buyer lined up?
Bahani's screens displayed bafflement, not following the subtext.
We will sell the damn thing back to the SEL before it goes to your lot, Ollie said flatly.
Now wait,
Chris started. But Ollie sent her such a murderous glower that she bit the words back. Solace, face absolutely calm, gave that a moment to hang in the air before saying,
I know that in the colonies they say a lot of things about my people. I've seen the Hugh propaganda too. We're warmongers. We're man-haters. We're unnatural. Born in a lab. Indoctrinated. Programmed like machines. All that I've heard. And nobody remembers we died for the colonies, above 100 worlds, during the war. We were the line.
And the softer edges of her voice were ablating off, revealing only steel beneath. Chris belatedly remembered this wasn't just third-generation ancestral pride. Solace had been there. She had fought in the war, faced the architects.
We were the shield and sword of the colonies, the Partheni went on. And then, when the war was over, you started asking why we had to keep on being different to you. Why couldn't we just come back and be your wives and daughters again? You really think we quit Hugh because we had some designs on your planets? Because we wanted to line all your menfolk up against a wall and make everyone else like us? We left because you hated us and would have used your laws to break us if we'd stayed.
She stood, jabbing a finger at Ollie.
All we ever did was put our lives on the line for you, and you still hate us for it. That, Ollie spat back, is not why I hate your bloody kind.
And Chris blinked. Because she'd noticed the friction between the two, the scowls and frowns from Ollie. She'd taken it for a clash of personalities, the rigid soldier against the prickly spacer.
Look at me, Myrmidon Executor Solace!
Ollie twisted in the capsule of her walking frame, stump arms and stump legs shifting.
Your precious eugenics wouldn't ever have made me, would it? You see a thing like me growing in your vats, you'd flush the contents out into space. Not fit for your perfect society, am I?
Chris saw anger twist Solace's face, rage there for a moment like a trapped beast, then just go, leaving a hollow expression on her face. The Partheni sat down abruptly.
What do you think we'd... Well, no, but...
Solace's eyes were fixed on Ollie, and everyone else was silent. Eventually, she said in quite a small voice, I don't know what to say. I mean, you're probably right. It would be before you were you, but... With the fleet's resources, we could... Chris waited for Ollie to go on the attack again, exploiting the breach. But the drone specialist had sagged back in her capsule, looking unhappy.
Listen, there will be a war between us someday. Maybe even when I'm alive to see it. Your side doesn't want it. Hugh sure as fuck doesn't want it. But it'll happen.
There won't...
Solis started. But Ollie just rolled over her words.
A war, she repeated. And you'll win, probably. You have the best ships. But we colonials, we're awkward buggers. We won't just behave ourselves. So you'll have to make us better people, won't you? Just like your Parthenon is full of better people than us. And you know what better people means? It means that people who aren't like you don't have a future, if you win. So the Parthenon doesn't get this box.
Solis took a deep breath.
That wouldn't happen. We don't want to change people.
You said yourself. We hate you,
Ollie told her quietly.
That's a real grand high horse. You can look down from on high, knowing that you're hated by dumb, regular, inferior humans. Gives you the moral right to do all sorts of things for the greater good. You're going to straight up swear to me that there's no chance, none at all, it'd go like that.
There was quite a silence after that. Probably Solis should have been advancing all sorts of guarantees about the future intentions of her government. But Chris reckoned she was a fundamentally honest person.
I am actually starting to hope these things are fake, Idris dropped in, when the quiet had become unbearable.
Overwhelming possibility, agreed Kit.
Chris watched the tilt of his mandibles as they whittled against one another. There was a language to the angles there. You could tell something of his mood, not Hanny moods in general, but Kittering in particular. Because he'd been around humans for years and had taken something of them into himself. Right now, he was unhappy, plain enough.
Then let's focus on that, if we have the real deal or not, Solis suggested. All right, I'll get me artifact verification tools out, shall I?
Ollie snapped, then looked away.
Fine, okay, not constructive.
It's all right. Solis pressed her hands to her face briefly. Then she was abruptly bright, businesslike, everything else pushed away.
If you do want to check their veracity first, I have a suggestion. And it's not take them to a Parthenon assessor before you ask. Idris, do you remember Trine?
Idris twitched at his name, then frowned.
Do I... Wait, you mean the research hive? That Trine?
Chris looked from one to the other as Solis nodded, sensing the submerged weight of their unspoken memories.
But they can't still be around. They'd have gone back to the assembly, surely. Whatever Trine is now.
Idris stuttered to a halt.
The longest instanced hive of consciousness ever. Almost as old as we are, Solis said dryly.
How?
An expert's an expert. I was sent to consult with them years back. They've been working on dig sites across multiple jurisdictions ever since the war. I can find out where they are now. We can go there, if that's what people want.
Explain, Ollie pressed.
This was back in the war, sure, Ollie agreed. Who or what is Trine? A hiver?
After Lycos, studying originators became top priority, Idris explained. They set up a whole war department to find out how their relics repelled the architects. Needless to say, that's not something anyone ever found out. Then there was Karis, when we realised we knew even less than we thought. They flew a team from one site to the next, gathering data late on in the war. Partheni ships because they could get out of trouble best. Int pilots because we cut corners fastest. I hadn't thought any of those guys were still around, but... Trine was a hiver. Or, back then, Trine was just an asset of the archaeology team because hivers weren't people. But they talked like a person. They curated all the data for the others, which meant they basically knew more than anyone. It's Hard to believe that instance of them is still around, honestly.
I think Trine intends to go on until the work's done, Solace said, which could well be forever.
And they can tell us if these things are real, Ollie pressed.
If anyone can, Solace confirmed. There is literally no greater expert on originator relics outside the hegemony. And I don't think we want to head that way, right?